appreciate that. And we're about to get started. Thank you once again. Moving on, Glenn.
I may also flash these.
Okay, please do.
Okay. If you haven't already, now would be a good time to grab yourself a bottle of water and get comfortable. And with our welcome.
Thanks, Audrey. Welcome, everyone, to the second in our Black Maternal Health workshop series. We started in February with the screening of the documentary. I think some of you were there, and I know that you're here to learn more today about specific and personal experiences, and we're so grateful for our panel. So I don't think my job is to introduce everybody. I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about the coalition. A lot of you already know about the coalition, but for those who don't, definitely on your way out, grab some information. We are a racial integration and inclusion and equity organization that's been around since 1997. We work in all areas of community life, residential, marketing, promoting the townships based on our integration culture, community engagement, and what am I missing? Did I say residential? Focus on integrating neighborhoods, yes. Schools, that was the other thing. Residential and schools, those are so tightly tied together, how we are able to integrate and whether we can integrate those two things are connected. So learn more about us. We are volunteer-based. We have a board of trustees and lots of committees with many, many community volunteers on them. I'm grateful today for Robert Marchman, our chair, of the board is here. We have committee members. We have Nancy Adams, mayor of Maplewood Township. Grateful for her presence. Another trustee, Barbara Velasquez, I just want to give a shout out to you because Barbara really started us on the maternal health focus. You forget, we had a coffee shop, coffee house discussion in, it was Black health issues, but we did. We had a coffee house discussion right in this room. It was quite a while ago, but you've put us on a path of thinking about these issues, and we're grateful for that. So with that, Audrey, who am I passing the mic to now?
Passing to me.
All right.
And I'm not enough.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, everyone, and happy Women's Month. We thank the women, and we thank the men who have come out to celebrate with us. And as part of that, we are offering this session today on Black maternal health. I have the privilege of introducing you to our panelists, and I can honestly say that they are my sheroes. Many of them I've worked with, some I have met for the first time, but in reading what they've contributed, I certainly would identify them as a shero. The first person I'd like to introduce, and their names are in front of them for your convenience, is Marie Kinsella. And she's raising her hand there. Marie is the Director of Community Programs for the Partnership for Maternal and Child Health of Northern New Jersey. She actually wears two hats. She also very recently has become a doula, and she's going to be talking today from both of those positions. In her position with the Maternal and Child Health of Northern New Jersey, she oversees five counties and numerous programs, such as the evidence-based home visitation program, and you'll learn more about the universal visitation, and community health workers and Connect New Jersey. She has supported the inception of two centering pregnancy centers, and she's been over 20 years as a member of the fetal infant mortality review team dedicated to Northern New Jersey. She holds a master's degree in community health with a concentration in minority health. And she is a master's certified health education specialist, as well as an adjunct professor in the health science department of New Jersey City University. And as I said, and more recently, she has become a doula. So you can see she certainly has a lot that she'll be able to share with us. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Sitting next to Marie, my papers will stay in my folder, we have someone that I have the pleasure of knowing personally, but today she comes to us on our panel. She is a professor at Rutgers University, a writer, and an active community member. Many of us know her as one of the founders or co-founder of Soma Justice here in Maplewood. She also is a mom of three. Her son, Aiken, who's 7, Ella, who's 5, and Omanira, who is 1 year old. All three of them were born in St. Barnabas Hospital here in Livingston, as was Khadija. She also has a cat named Sunny and a dog named Havoc, so we can imagine what he does. And she's lived in Maplewood for the last decade and grew up in South Orange as a child and is a graduate of our own Columbia High School. Welcome, Khadija. And next we have Dr. Camille Walker. Dr. Camille Walker states her focus as being able to influence policies and procedures for maternal health governance with the goal of reducing maternal and fetal morbidity and mortality. She also is focused on direct interaction with high-risk maternal patients to improve their care and outcome on an individual basis. She has a PhD that she received from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and she has done her residency work at Howard University, which many of us are familiar with, and professionally she has done a lot of her work as a perinatalist, working to interpret ultrasounds and to co-manage high-risk pregnancies. She's worked in so many locations, I can't even name them all. One of them even including Maplewood, New Jersey. She also had a private practice here in South Orange for a while. She's managed and co-managed high-risk pregnancies, and she's licensed and board certified as an obstetrics, gynecology, and maternal fetal medicine. She's also lectured and written abstracts on this topic. So please welcome Dr. Walker. And last, we have our very own Maplewood resident and past trustee of the coalition, Tegan Culler. Tegan was trained as a public health professional with a background in reproductive health, health systems, and HIV. She's worked focusing on reducing and eliminating health disparities, particularly those driven by social determinants of health, such as race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. Ms. Culler has designed and delivered trainings for the New Jersey Department of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on trauma-informed care and maternal mortality. She's also the proud mother of 2 daughters and is currently serving as a Girl Scout leader. And she's taken time off from that duty to join us today. And she's going to lead us into our discussion by giving you a little bit more background, and then we'll begin getting input from our panelists. Tegan.
Audrey, thank you so much. And thank you to our panelists and our guests here today for joining us. I want to just take a few minutes to set the context, and many of you may be aware of the background of maternal mortality and maternal morbidity, or just generally maternal health in the U.S., and the racial disparities that are inherent in our culture, and have been inherent since we started looking at the data over 100 years ago. However, they are sobering, so I'm going to share this. Among developed nations, the U.S. has the worst maternal mortality rate of any, and the third highest infant mortality rate. These are major societal indicators of a country's health, and we're not doing so well. In our very own home state of New Jersey, we have the fourth highest maternal mortality rate in the country. We have, as of 2019, among states who reported, we had the highest Black maternal mortality rate in the country. So nationally, Black women are 3 to 4 times as likely to die from pregnancy-related causes as their non-Hispanic white counterparts. In New Jersey, that number is 7 times. So that's very stark and really shocking. And unfortunately, the disparities are not limited to Black women, although that disparity is the highest one. Among Hispanic and Latino women in New Jersey, that rate is 3.5 times the rate of white non-Hispanic women. Now, maternal mortality is a tragedy. Every death is something that ripples outward and affects families and communities, and is horrific. And even though these numbers are high, even so, this is a relatively rare event. But severe maternal morbidity, or an instance that could have occurred, that could have led to death, is much, much more common, much, much more common. So for every maternal death in the US, 70 to 80 women experience a near-miss event. So this is a really, really big deal. And when we look at the numbers of mortality alone, they're really shocking, but it does not tell the picture of the crisis that we're in. So I feel like I really wanted to share that piece. The disparities among in both death and in maternal morbidity among Black women and between Black women and their white non-Hispanic counterparts cut across socioeconomic status, they cut across education. They cut across insurance status as well. So this is really something that we need to be considering and paying attention to, particularly in New Jersey, where we otherwise have fairly strong health outcomes in our state. So as I sort of wrap up with those sobering statistics, I want to just acknowledge that a lot of times when we talk about numbers, and in public health, we talk about numbers all the time, but these are real people. These are people's lives. These are people's families. And so I want to really acknowledge the people who have been affected by this, the people who have experienced trauma, the people who are left behind. And as we have our conversation with our esteemed panelists today, I want to keep those pieces in mind, and the fact that all of these numbers and all of these experiences represent real people. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to one of our real people. Mm-hmm. We have Dr. Khadija Costley-White with us today, who's going to share some of her experiences, particularly with her most recent birth. Khadija?
Okay. Thank you. Wow. I didn't know a lot of what you just said, so I'm going to ask you to send that to me later to share, because that's those statistics are really startling, yeah, and I'm glad I didn't know it a year ago. I had 3 babies in the last 7 years, which feels like a lot, at least, and the little one is at home now, and so I was trying to think about like what to say today about all that. With my first one, I had preeclampsia and gestational diabetes and old. Well, I guess with the first one, I was technically not considered geriatric yet. But it was a complex pregnancy, and we didn't know about the preeclampsia until we got closer to the delivery, and then they released me, and I immediately had to be rehospitalized after I went home with the baby, and I ended up being separated from him for the first week of his life, which was very hard for me because of the eclampsia and the concern about me having a stroke after having the baby, which is not unusual, actually, and I wish they had kept me longer. So from that pregnancy on, I always insisted that I get an extra day or two, because I was so afraid of being separated from the baby if I ended up sick again. But actually, the first story that I thought about when I was asked to talk about this was meeting a working class Black woman who was at my son's daycare in Newark, who told me that she had delivered at a baby-friendly hospital in New York that refused to let her have formula when she was having a baby, because they insisted that she breastfeed. And it struck me as really fascinating that no matter how they kind of switch up the approach, it never seems to center the mother who was having the baby and the things that she wants and needs. And I was struck by the way that language had been used to basically, against her will, decide for her how she was gonna feed the baby and use her body. And so, you know, what that kind of sensitized me to, and it's, and I have another friend who's a doctor who told me about how they drug test the women who are on public insurance but not on private insurance. And so she's constantly having to deal with having patients in the hospital thinking their babies are going to be taken from them because they might have had like marijuana in their system or something like that, right after they deliver, and what that, how stressful that is to be a doctor in that circumstance. And so I guess what I wanted to say is, like, I'm a professor, I have private insurance, like, I had a bad, I have had bad experiences, but also I understand that, like, working class Black women in particular are targeted and threatened and stressed in ways that I did not experience. And just knowing that, is startling, right? Because I feel like I had, overall, I have all three kids, and I'm alive, and that's, like, a good thing. And there are women who can't say that about, or can't talk right now because of how they get treated when they're pregnant. So I wanted to just kind of state that. And Audrey, somewhere, you're going to give me a warning if I talk too long. I had only like a few points that I wrote down, which was like things that lingered with me after I had my first baby. One was the preoccupation with my weight, which actually the doctor insisting not only weighing me on everyone, but then lecturing me about my weight. And I actually, because of the gestational diabetes, and I was dieting basically, because they give you a whole diet that you can eat. At a certain point, I was afraid to eat because I was afraid I was going to eat the wrong thing. The doctor was saying that my sugars weren't reflecting what I was doing. And then to be hounded about my weight while I'm worried about all those things was really stressful. And actually, I dropped like 40 pounds in a month after I had the baby. A lot of it was water retention and all sorts of stuff. But that stayed with me. I almost left the practice because of that, because that was such a stressful experience. One of the positive things I remember from my first pregnancy is waking up from having the C-section, which was traumatic in and of itself because I hadn't planned on doing that. And seeing a nurse holding my baby in the corner and rocking him and feeding him. And that's the only time I remember seeing a nurse holding my baby and rocking them and feeding them, and that there's like a special wing at St. Barnabas that, that apparently I got the first time and I was never able to get again, but that stayed with me. And so I think that human connection, I guess, is the thing that is so valuable when you're having a baby. I had to be hospitalized in my first pregnancy because I had a fibroid that was dying, and that sounds weird, but it's really painful. It's really painful. It's basically like your baby is fighting this part of your body that is dying, and I was starting to have contractions because of it. So I had to get hospitalized, and that was my first experience with realizing that like your pain doesn't really get taken all that seriously, and your requests for pain medication also doesn't get taken all that seriously. In fact, like, I don't know if it's a trauma response or what, I still have pain medication from my first pregnancy at home, just because I'm now constantly worried that if I ever need pain medication again, a doctor won't give it to me. Because every time since then that I've asked for pain medication, I get a doctor who doesn't want to give me medication, which I don't apparently use because I have some of it left at home. But because I always am afraid of being in that kind of pain again and not having somebody respond to it. And I remember the techs being the ones that came into the room and seeing me sitting there in pain and saying, you can't be in pain like this. So it wasn't the nurses, it wasn't the doctors, it was like the medical techs who came in and saw me and said, no, I'm calling somebody for you. And so that is one of the things that to me is like something that stands out. With this most recent pregnancy, okay, so the thing I thought, so I like every pregnancy, I was like, I'm gonna get this next one, right? You know? And so I was like, this last one, the last two, I was like, I'm gonna have my white friends on call, right? And so I like put out a call in my like social justice group and like among my friends, I was like, if you wanna be my on call backup white friends, because at that point my husband would probably have to be with one of the kids or two of the kids, please let me know, or my family's helping. So there was with the second baby, I was so anxious because of the hospitalization from the first one. I ended up going back when I had to keep track of my blood pressure, And my white friend came, but she's a doula. I was like, I need somebody here. And it was so necessary because first I was in the hallway. They finally, and I said, I kept saying, I have to breastfeed. Like I have to pump. I can't be here for too long not pumping. The baby was like 2 weeks old and I was in a lot of discomfort and they weren't listening to me. But then my white friend came and she's like, she says she needs to nurse, she needs to pump. You need to find a space for her to pump. And they were like, oh, we'll find a space for her to pump. And so like I'm in the room, I'm finally getting to pump. And then I was like, I'm so hungry. I've not eaten and I had the baby and I came here and I said it, but like nobody was listening to me. They kind of came in and did their stuff. My friend was like, she's hungry. So you guys need to find food for her right now. And they were like, oh, okay, we'll go get something for her to eat. So it was like, I learned very quickly that having somebody speaking for you and like and asserting for you in the space, even if it couldn't be a partner, is really important. And I'm probably almost done. So I'll say one more thing. With the last time I had this baby most recently, this doula friend helped me come up with a list of things to make sure I had to make myself comfortable when I went to have birth. And when I went there all prepared, like none of them, they were all just kind of ignored. So I don't know. I don't know if that's something we can talk about, but it was like music you might want. Can you put the EKG in the spot so I can do skin to skin with the baby? Can I see her and hold her before you? Can you lower the drape so I can see when she delivers? All these things that I kind of wanted that were just kind of, can you introduce yourselves in the room so I know who's stabbing me in the back or who's like cutting into me in the front? And like none of that happened. So I don't know. I don't know how you advocate for yourself better. Maybe that's the kind of the best way to segue, which is like, I'm safe and I'm okay. But also the experience made it pretty terrifying for me to think about I'm never having another child, so that's shut down. But ever being hospitalized again and so I'm glad that you guys are having the panel and I'm glad that we're having the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing, Khadija. We appreciate it. I have a feeling, and I see it on your faces, that Dr. Walker and Marie, we both have a lot of thoughts about this. Just initially, Dr. Walker, would you share your response as a clinician?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Thank you for sharing that. That's hard. I think it's hard to be a pregnant patient in this day and age, especially a Black woman. I try to understand from a physician point of view, we and a nursing staff point of view, we're trying to we feel is best for the patient, and we're not listening to the patient. And that's one of the issues that is in terms of listening to the patient, and we're not, because I think there would be better outcomes. One of the issues I know that has been discussed, that will be discussed, that I want to discuss is regarding midwives, for instance.
Yes.
We need more midwives, we need more doulas, because studies have definitely shown there's less cesarean section rate, decreased preterm birth rate, improved breastfeeding, because of the fact that they're listening to the patient, the doulas are advocating for the patient. And I think this is a direction that we need to go in. If you look at the European countries, majority of their patients, actually over about 75% of them, are delivered by midwives. Whereas here in the United States, it's actually less than 10%. So I think we have to change. The healthcare system is broken from a maternal point of view. It works for some people, but from a Black maternal point of view, it does not work. It's broken. We're trying to work within it, but it definitely needs to be fixed. And part of it is listening to the patient. The Black Maternal Health Week, which was originated by the Black Mamas Alliance, that was one of their key mottos, listen to the patient. I've had patients tell me, you're not listening to me, and I give kudos to the patients because of the fact that they have empowered themselves to stick up for themselves, but they're going to be patients who are not. So thank you for sharing that. And I know that's hard, but we're trying to do better from the healthcare perspective.
Thanks.
Excuse me, thank you. As you pass the mic, I would ask if you would pull the mics a little bit closer.
Okay.
We've maxed out the volume, but I'm sure that no one wants to miss any of the information you shared. Mm-hmm. If you'd like to take it out of the holder, you're welcome to do that.
Okay.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because there were things that you said that struck a chord with me, things that I've seen in my experience as someone who oversees programs, someone who has directly worked and heard these stories time and time again. So really, thank you. And for being courageous and having two more babies. Because there are women who are saying, after that first experience, I'm not doing this. Even though they want it, I'm not doing this. And I see that. You know, you brought up the drug and pain medication issue. One of the things that we've known, and I used to work with pregnant substance users of all races, there is this idea when you go into the hospital and you need and you're Black that you are drug seeking. Mm-hmm. And we need to really take a look at that. It doesn't matter who you are. Dr. Walker, perhaps, mm-hmm. could go into a hospital talking mm-hmm. about pain. They don't know that she's a physician.
Right.
And again, they treat her as she's someone who's drug seeking.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's sad that you had to, you know, that you had to share safety pain medication from the first baby. The other thing you talked about was weight bias. There's a lot of that. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with Rutgers Echo series, which I'm a part of. It's called Maternal Health Innovation. And just last Tuesday, we had a presentation on weight bias in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And everything that you shared were the things that we were talking about. And it's just very sad when someone cannot comfortably go through their pregnancy and they have to worry about being shamed. Some of it, you know, is implicit. You know, the providers don't really know the impact that it's having on the patient. So I really thank you for sharing that. There were just so many things that you said, and I'm just happy to be in the presence of you and Dr. Walker and all of you. You know, because this is the only way we're going to get the message out, that this is a shame, and thank you for sharing that, Tegan. It's a shame that Black women are 7 times more likely in the state of New Jersey to die than their white counterparts. It's terrible, you know, and we all should be outraged. And I know it's about systemic change, and we can do that. So, thank you.
Thank you.
So that's for me.
So Marie, we're actually going to move to you now. You've started us off. We'd love to hear a little bit more as your experience as a doula and as someone who runs programs in this area.
So, you know, I'll tell you when my journey started in terms of working in this profession. Many years ago, you know, my husband and I, we got married young, we took jobs that we had to take so we could take care of our families, and at some point in time, he was like, because I wanted to go back to school, and we said, well, you can stop working and go back to school, kids are, you know, and so the first organization that I worked at was a federally qualified health center, and one of my goals was, the job I was given was to connect with women around reproductive health issues, and I'm going back to 1992, 93. And just talking with the community, there was when you go out into the community, you hear the stories. You hear what people think, why people may not be doing this or that, what we consider to be the right thing to do. They have their reasons for, I'm not doing that. And you know, and one of the main sounds that I heard when it came to reproductive health, and this came from the male population, Black male population, that's really genocide. So don't talk to my family about birth control and family planning. But in that role, I was introduced to Black infant mortality. And I don't know how many of you remember, but back in 1993, we had a campaign called Black Infants Better Survivals. Our Black babies in the state of New Jersey were dying at a rate of 3 to 4 times more than their white counterparts. Again, a shame. And with that, I had just started college, and you know, I said, I gotta do, you know, I want to be involved in this. And that's where my interest in looking at racial disparities, specifically with Black women. And I heard someone mention HIV and pregnancy. And, you know, I've been blessed to be in so many spaces to learn about these things. And so my journey with programming has certainly been that. I eventually switched from providing services to women who are substance users during pregnancy. I was able to get, and I still want to go back to the beginning. I want to get maternal child health. And I was fortunate enough 18 years ago to get a position at what we call the Northern Consortium at that time. Now it's the Partnership for Maternal and Child Health. And, you know, just doing the work. And so I love it, overseeing, connecting. And Jay, we'll talk about those programs a little bit later. But more importantly, we're going to talk about what's happening, number one, for women. I'm so happy that we have Women's Health Month. We had the Day of International Women yesterday. But, you know, for somebody who was in, you know, overseeing all of these programs, I'm not seeing things really change. I'm still seeing black women villainized, you know, by the medical profession when it came to certain things. Because when you would talk about maternal and infant death, the first thing they would say, oh, they're probably drug users, mm-hmm. or they're probably this, or they're probably that. And what we know is, especially when it comes to maternal health, we know that a black woman, college educated, making $300,000, $400,000 a year, has less of a chance surviving mm-hmm. than a white woman who doesn't even have a high school education. Mm-hmm. So let's just put that out there. And you know, so I've been infuriated through the years. And I remember we had a blue ribbon panel around trying to look at the issue. And at that time, that was, I think, 1997. Do you remember the Blue Ribbon panel? And what they were saying was that racism could be a factor. And they were still saying whether it was or it wasn't. Yes. So today, thank goodness we've moved past that. But as I said, someone who was overseeing programs and still seeing this, and one day I was sitting in a meeting and they were talking about, well, what do you think you'll be doing in 5 years? What would you like to do? And out of my mouth popped, I want to be a doula. And I said, where did that come from? But I started processing that. And that was my personal way. Because yes, I work professionally, have some wonderful programs who are providing great services to the community and supporting them. But what was I doing as an individual? And so I got my training. I don't support a lot of women. I do what I can. I usually support 3 to 4 a year. And it's just, and I feel so blessed to be able to be in the birthing space. Because that's sacred. You know, when a woman asks you or the family asks you to come in and be a part of that. So I don't take that lightly. And to your point, you know, for me, one of the last clients that I had, preeclampsia was an issue. It was an issue all through her pregnancy. And we would talk about it, and yes, we had our birth plan, and she's like, I don't want to have a cesarean, and couldn't get that blood pressure managed, and she was doing all the right things. She and her husband, they were taking walks, she was dieting, just couldn't get it managed. And when it came to the time for the birth, 32 hours, and we still had, the baby still wasn't delivered because of her high blood pressure, she had to be on magnesium, and then body, a couple of other things, which actually delay contractions. And so in talking with her and her family, you know, because it was their decision what we wanted to do. And so the baby was delivered to C-section. But to your point, baby went home, mom didn't. And it was really sad for her. But, you know, I tried to give her as much support. And by the way, she had a wonderful perineatologist her OB, her perinatologist, she didn't care for too much because she felt like that person wasn't listening to her. So anybody who's going into the medical field and you want to be, you know, that perinatologist that's high-risk OB, be considerate of what people are saying and how you're talking to people. Mm-hmm. She felt, and I've had three patients, clients over the last 2 years who had terrible experiences with their perinatologist, and thank God for their OBs who understood. But again, for me, the journey was just being there to provide support, getting you through because we all know labor is going to be painful, but trying to get you through it with the least pain possible, but also provide you with the information so you can become a self-advocate. We can have that birth plan. We can say, and I can whisper to you in your ear, is this something you want? Is it because on your birth plan, you have the right to say that to that professional. The thing is, like Dr. Walker pointed out, is getting that professional to listen. Mm-hmm. So my journey as being a doula has been wonderful. I've supported. Oh, and by the way, I'm a mommy of five. I have 18 grandchildren.
Oh my God.
Wait a minute. And I have 20 great grands and get ready to have another one.
So, yes, yes.
And so my last three great grandbabies, I was there, but not as their grandma. I was there to support as the doula and make sure. And I remember when they were giving my granddaughter. When they were stitching her, because again, we didn't want episiotomies. And she said she had more pain with that than delivering, and she's telling them, and the doctor still, and I said, excuse me, did you hear her say she's having a lot of pain? So let's do something about that. I said, that is her grandmother. It was just, again, we need to listen to people. So I think this is such a wonderful conversation. It's so wonderful to see all of you here. And so I love being a doula. Like I said, I can only do this for you because, you know, getting that call, but I still have my full-time job. But I do know that when I retire, I'm going to be marching because I can. And we need to extend maternity leave and bonding for all women, you know, who are giving birth. And I said, because I won't be bound by the grants or any of that, I'm going to be fierce. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Can I just say, one of the things I learned too was that you don't have to rely on, I mean, this is just if there's any people planning on having kids anytime soon. I didn't know that you didn't have to rely on the people in the hospital to manage your pain and all that. I learned after that first pregnancy, when my doctor was like, oh, you should have just called me. Remember, you didn't tell me to call you. And so after that, I realized, like, oh, I can just call my doctor. I don't have to wait for them or the nurse to arrive and the residents to decide whether or not I deserve to have pain medication. I can just call my doctor. And so from then on, I would just call my doctor and get my pain medication called in. That's probably obvious to a lot of people. It was not obvious to me. I thought that you would ask the nurse and the nurse would come back to the doctor. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kinsella, for your story, and Khadija for bringing this up. I think that actually we don't operate this way in the U.S. We don't think about healthcare teams except what's right in front of us because we know there's a lot of turf issues. And I think one of the things that we could consider is how do we get the word out about things like that? And I wanted to ask you, Ms. Kinsella, could you just, I think everybody is I saw a lot of heads nodding as you were speaking, but could you give us the 90-second version of what a doula does for folks who may not know that information?
So first of all, a doula is that, is that support person. You know, we're there to provide information, education, but more than that, to empower that client to talk about the things that are really going to be important during their pregnancy and subsequent delivery. How do you plan on feeding the baby? What are some of the things that, what do you want your birth plan to look like? How do you want it to go? What things are you concerned about? You know, a lot of times we don't ask people that. I guess we're kind of afraid. And the other thing is you talk about pain management. So for anyone who's had a doula, you know that once you get into that active labor, and those pains start coming, there's things that we can do. You know, there's massage rubs. There's, you know, we can take, there's a way that we can help you manage the pain by pulling. You pull, we pull, and that kind of relieves some of the pain. Breathing. By the way, breathing is really a great, great technique for managing pain. In fact, you know, the last time I was at the hospital, that worked so well with, you know, one of the young ladies that I was working with. But we're there to provide emotional, physical, and spiritual support in terms of, you know, what the person needs, what they want, but always be centered on what they want. It's not about what I want to see or anyone else. It's about what do you want and how can I best support you? And by the way, there's what we call full spectrum doulas, which cover pregnancy, labor and delivery, and postpartum. I am a full spectrum doula, but we also have pregnancy doulas just through the pregnancy. And then you have the LND, doulas who are there for that, and then you have postpartum, which when we get a chance, you know, we have a new program at the partnership. You know, last year when we were talking about funding with the Department of Health, I said, I think we need to look at postpartum. Because what happens when mommy comes home from the hospital, she's feeling a little dizzy, you know, she's saying, oh, it's just probably because I'm tired, the baby's been up, not recognizing that could be a sign of eclampsia, preeclampsia. Or maybe she needs support with lactation, you know. And that's the other thing, I am a certified lactation consultant, so that, you know, we can make sure that, you know, baby's getting what they need. We can reassure mom, yes, the baby's getting enough milk, because that's usually the number one thing they say. But, you know, just there to provide support all in any way we can. And as a postpartum doula, you might want to go in sometimes. Mommy needs to take a shower. Mm-hmm. Maybe dad's at work. So we can watch that baby while, you know, we do little light housekeeping. No major cooking or anything like that, but you do have some people who are able to stay overnight. That's not what a community doula does, and we'll talk about the difference at some point. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it did, thank you. And Dr. Walker, yes. Do you have a response to anything that Ms. Kinsella shared?
So I think doulas are definitely very important, also community health workers. I think the big issue now is reimbursement. A lot of doulas are, you know, private based, and I think they're moving forward. I think California, as a matter of fact, has started paying doulas, and so I think that's where we need to move, where insurance companies are paying for doulas and community health workers, because of the fact that it is part of the team, you know, when we're taking care of a pregnant patient, it's teamwork. The patient is the center. It's not before it used to be the pyramid, you know, where the doctor was at the top. But now it's really patient-centered care that's important, because that's what's going to improve the outcomes.
New York State Medicaid is reimbursing for doulas.
Okay, so now, so okay.
And somebody asked me to write a grant for the. Oh yeah, a local principal like asked me to write it. Her granddaughter had a grant in North Carolina, so they're doing grants now. But you have to apply for it, you know, if you can't write well, or, you know, that may discourage people. I wanted to say, if anybody is getting a lactation consultant, I learned that they're actually required, insurance companies are required to cover lactation consultants when you leave. A lot of them don't have, like my insurance doesn't have lactation consultant in network, so they have to cover it in full. But they tried not to. So I just wanted to put that out there. I submitted for reimbursement. They only submitted partial reimbursement. And then I literally just, like last week, got the check for the second part, because I called and said, you never sent me the whole check. And they're like, oh, let me, we gave you your reimbursable rate, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually they were like, oh yeah, you're right. We're supposed to give you everything. So just wanted to let people know.
I just have to say a little bit about that Medicaid. And yes, you know, I think New Jersey is going in the right direction, but at one time, you know, they were only given $800 per birth, you know, due to the female legislators, actually, those state senators and those wonderful assembly women, we weren't able to increase it. So now it's $1,600 per birth. But think about that. And the process is overwhelming. So there's been a lot of discussion with the consortiums, not just ours, but the three consortiums in the state, to improve the process of reimbursement. And let's bring that up a little more, because you really can't make, you know, if someone's doing private doula work and trying to stay with, you know, use that as a means of support, it's very difficult. And when I say private doula, I'm talking about community doula, so that everybody has access. And, you know, if you have $5,000 to pull and pay out of pocket, that's one thing. But we know that most of our residents, you know, here in New Jersey do not have that. So while we're doing okay, we need to keep going with reimbursing the doulas. And Dr. Walker, thank you for saying being a part of the birthing team. I was actually pleased to be working at a hospital in Passaic County. I'm not going to name them, but they were wonderful. And when we started going in, we were treated as a part of the birthing team.
They told us to put on scrubs.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be, and it was just wonderful. And you know what it did?
Please do tell us.
Yes.
It was St. Joseph's,
who was really trying to turn around a terrible reputation that they had.
Yeah.
But we have said, because I'm a trainer as well, and our trainees do their observations there. They are part of the birthing team and welcomed by all doctors, and not just midwives, but the physicians as well. And I've seen that. I've been there at night supporting someone, and a doctor comes up and, you know, is really interested about the work they do. And by the way, they've just hired 6 doulas to work in the hospital to provide that support. So I think, you know, championing that for the hospitals across the state. You know, we talk about baby friendly, that might be something you want to think about.
Can I just, if I had a midwife, I probably would have done my first pregnancy very differently.
Mm-hmm.
But because my doctor was basically like, well, it's the weekend, I'm about to go, and I'm not going to be on this weekend. So either you have the baby now, or you can have the baby with somebody who's here during the weekend. And at that point, I was like, well, I don't want to have the baby with some random person I don't know. And so I ended up just saying, okay, well, I guess we'll just have the baby now. And I think if I had an option of having someone else who was like, well, I'll be here if you decide that. And that was even with my third baby. It was like, well, we're all off because it's Halloween weekend. You know, we're all off this weekend, our kids, you know, so if you're going to have the baby, you need to schedule it this day, right? And I was like, well, I kind of wanted to wait a little bit for the baby. I know, this makes it sound, I should have changed that. I was looking for a woman of color, and I wanted in her whole staff, and then when she expanded her office, she had another black woman doctor, and she added another woman of color. And so for me, it was like, that was what attracted me at first. And then when I tried to go to another practice, I realized, well, I'll see a different midwife every time I go, and I won't see my doctor. So it's really hard to figure out where to go to get support, especially when you're nervous and scared to see someone consistently. And the other thing I want to say was, I thank you for your work, because I think, you know, doulas are covered the way lactation consultants are. If the state passes laws that allow, you know, insurance or requires insurance companies to provide and cover doulas and midwives, like, I think we would see a shift in what is happening. So, I don't know if you're going to talk about this at some point, but I think the postpartum stuff is really important too, because like when you leave, how many people have had kids in here? Is it most of the people in here? So like when you leave, they like constantly have you now filling out surveys to tell them whether or not you're suicidal and depressed. And it becomes almost a joke because like they give it to you because they have to, you fill it out because you have to. And I think, I mean, I don't know if I'm unusual, but as a black woman, I'm very sensitive to things that are asking me if I'm crazy or not. And especially because I don't want anybody taking my baby. I don't want anybody hospitalizing me. I don't want anybody institutionalizing me against my will. So I'm almost never honest on any of those anyway. Because I'm like, well, what are you going to do? Let's say I am super depressed. Are you going to do anything? You didn't do anything when I said I couldn't walk up the stairs. You didn't do anything when I said I wanted to have the baby to 2 days. Why would I think you're going to do anything if I say I'm super depressed right now? And for me, I haven't dealt with depression. I'm probably more anxious than anything postpartum. But I feel like, you know, that kind of stuff too falls through the cracks. Once you have the baby, the doctors are just like, okay, well, you're alive. Good to see you. Now you should find like a new doctor. And then you go back to the regular doctor you haven't seen in like a year because you've been going to the swim every month. And it's a really hard transition, so I didn't know if we could talk about
that. I was going to talk about that part of the presentation,
yes.
But if you want me to save it for the presentation, or well, I can talk about it now.
It's
so
your turn anyway.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. So, you know, we know about the information about black mortality, we know the statistics, we know the reasons, and we know the solutions, and I still don't understand why we're still having this issue, why we're having this discussion. You know, every time I'm on computer, Microsoft Edge, you know, they have all these different articles that pop up, and there's always one every day that's related to Black mortality and Black maternal health. You know, so I'm still racking in my mind why are we still having this discussion. And I just wanted to just expand upon Audrey's in terms of numbers and statistics in terms of maternal mortality. New Jersey, it was 25 per 100,000 live births in terms of maternal mortality. California was actually 10.1. And California has actually been doing a great job in terms of decreasing maternal mortality, but we still have the problem with Black women where they still have a higher rate. And then when you look at the resource-rich countries, the next level is actually France and Canada at 8.7 and 8.6. So that is such a big discrepancy, you know, for the United States that we're up high at, you know, 23, and then the next of France and Canada at 8.7. Then when you look at the Black mortality, you know, as stated before, it's 2 to 3 times higher, but in New Jersey, 7 times higher. The big thing, about 80% of this is preventable. And that's what's scary, is that 80% of maternal mortality is preventable. And another issue is about 60 to 65% of maternal mortality occurs either at the time of delivery or in the postpartum period. And I think that's an area where we need to focus on, and I'm going to talk about that later, what we call now the fourth trimester.
Right.
And I think that's an area, like I said, we definitely have to focus on. So I'm going to briefly just talk about some of the causes. I'm not going to go into much detail. You know, we've already talked about the structural racism, implicit bias, in the policies and programs that create the differential access to health care. So for instance, you talked about drug use. I don't know if you all heard about it. In 2023, they had two women of color who they did drug tests random, and they didn't know about it, and they came back positive for opiates, but they ate poppy seeds bagels. And poppy seed bagels are known to actually cause the urine to be positive for opiates. So they were not made aware. They called DIFAS. It was a whole issue, and I think there is a lawsuit in progress because of the fact that they do drug testing unauthorized. You're supposed to let the patients know. And they specifically, like I said, these were two women of color. And studies have actually shown that white women actually have a positive test more than Black women. Other things, we look at epidural use. You know, the New Jersey actually on the government, their website, they actually have maternal health cards for each hospital here in New Jersey. And I happened to look at one hospital where the epidural use is, you know, 69%, whereas the hospital in Newark is 26%. You know, you want to, they're both within the same hospital system. You know, why is there a discrepancy in terms of epidural use? Also in terms of the interaction with patients. You know, I don't like the baby daddy. You know, that has been used, and some people did, they're offended by that. Mm-hmm. You know, it should be partner. Husband, it should be a term of respect when you're interacting with patients. Also, healthcare access is a problem. You know, where I work at Norbeth Israel, we're understaffed, so sometimes, unfortunately, prenatal access, sometimes it may take 3 weeks for a patient to get a first prenatal visit, and that shouldn't happen, but it is happening. You know, and part of it is just lack of, it's an under-resourced hospital, in certain areas, not all areas, and you know, I still do feel that we do provide you know, good care to the patients, but you know, we are under-sourced. Also, underlying medical conditions, Black women do have there's a higher risk of having underlying medical conditions, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and some people have linked that to something called weathering. Because of the stresses that Black women do undergo, that we are at a higher risk for having these medical conditions. And that is the reason, as you talked about in terms of college-educated women, they still have a higher risk of maternal mortality compared to a white woman that has less than a high school education. Also just other things, delayed recognition and risk and of complications, variation in quality of care, and also just lack of insurance. These are all just factors that play a role in, you know, in Black mortality or maternal mortality. And there's so many different solutions. They're all multifaceted. There's just not one solution, mm-hmm. not one size fits all. Different communities require different management. So for instance, in Essex County, we see more complications related to hypertension, heart disease, bleeding, whereas in Southern Jersey, it's more substance abuse and mental health. So you do have to, when you're looking at the community, you just don't just do one treatment. It's different treatments based on the community. And it involves healthcare system, legislation, policy, community engagement, patient and education. All of these things play a role in us improving maternal mortality, but especially in the Black community. And we know this, and I feel like a broken record sometimes because we know this, and I'm still trying to rack my mind why have we not moved further. I mean, we are moving in the right direction, but I think I just feel that I guess we should have been a little bit further along in terms of taking care of our women population. So some of the solutions, I'm just gonna focus on the healthcare system and the patient. Have a practitioner that's drug testing women for no reason. You need to ask them why. We need to continue with practice evidence-based medicine. There are several bundles for management of preeclampsia, postpartum hemorrhage, and we need to follow them. Because this has been vetted, this is evidence-based medicine that says this is how you need to manage a patient with preeclampsia, this is how you need to manage a patient who is bleeding. And if you follow it, you know, the outcome is better than as opposed to not following it at all. So I think that's definitely important. I think there should be mandatory webinars. You talked about the Echo Lab. I was trying to remember the name because I think this is great for practitioners to participate in these webinars and just learn to keep their knowledge base fresh and up to date. And I think that's important. Now we do have to go through certifications and OBGYN. We do every year, we have to take an exam, we have to read articles. So we do have a recertification process. But I also think these webinars are just as important in terms of training us to keep up to date. So I'm going to talk about the fourth trimester. I think it's a very important trimester because of the fact that the majority of the maternal mortality occurs during that time frame. But at the same time, the statistics show that about 40% of women do not go for their postpartum visit. And I think it's very important that we recognize the importance of the fourth trimester. I think we're doing some great things. I think one of the great things we're doing is that we've expanded the maternity coverage for 12 months here in New Jersey, as well as several other states. I think now they have a home visiting nurse that's free. I think two visits in the postpartum. Okay, so I won't talk about that. But and then we've also changed our protocol in terms of when patients follow up. So before it used to be 6 weeks. 2 weeks if you had a C-section to check the incision. Now if you have a patient who's had preeclampsia, the recommendation is we need to see them within a week, okay? And then the recommendation for everybody else is 3 weeks. So I think we are definitely making changes in this strive to improve the maternal outcome. We even have, at Beth Israel, we have a cardi obstetrics because hypertension and preeclampsia is very prevalent in our community. We actually have a cardio-obstetrics physician now who is assisting us in managing patients who have hypertension or cardiac diseases. There also needs to be accountability and transparency. The good thing is we have the Maternal Mortality Review Board here in New Jersey. It's actually one of the oldest maternal mortality review boards, I think since the 1930s. We, you know, several hospitals have peer review committees so that if there's a more adverse outcome, we review it so we can determine how can we make changes. So these are just some of the things that I think that, you know, are available. We just need to do them. In terms of what can women do, women need to advocate for themselves, and I think women are listening to the messages, you know, and they are advocating for themselves, saying, hey, this is not right. I think that's important. I think preconceptional counseling is important, so that if you're thinking of getting pregnant, if you had a previous adverse outcome in a previous pregnancy, I think it's important to be seen prior to the pregnancy, so things can be managed differently. If you're a diabetic, if you're hypertensive, so we can change your medicine, so as to improve the pregnancy outcome. And that includes preconception counseling, prenatal care, and I still think the importance of postpartum care is very important. I think also there's access to a lot of information. There's something called the Earth app. I don't know if anybody has heard about that.
Kimberly Stiers.
Right, correct. It's essentially a Yelp app for women of color where they can review their care and talk about it. And I think that's important, you know, because of the fact that we need to know which hospitals, you know, where to avoid or where you need to make sure that you're strongly advocating for yourself. You also need to know if you're a previous cesarean section, for instance, and you want an attempt at a vaginal delivery. Not all doctors will want to do that. Not all hospitals want to do that. So you need to know, you know, the statistics of your hospital. So again, the New Jersey government website, they have, like I said, a health card for each hospital. They talk about the number of cesarean section rates, the postpartum hemorrhage, the hypertension, diabetes rates. So that's something that you can use if you're trying to decide which hospital you want to deliver.
Where is that?
It's newjersey.gov, and it is the maternal health stats. So I just finally want to just say we all need to be part of the change. You know, whether that's telling somebody, you know, advocate for yourself, whether or not it's being part of all these great organizations here that are dealing with maternal health, whether you want to be a physician, doula, midwife, nurse, you know, to just be part of the team, you know, taking care of and improving maternal health care for Black women, but for all women here in the United States, because our rates are abysmal. They're abysmal compared to other resource-rich countries. And like I said, it's a multi-pronged approach, and I think change begins with education and communication. And I don't know who, this is an unknown author, and they say the biggest communication problem is we do not listen to understand. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. We listen to reply.
Yeah.
You know, and we've all done it. You know, we're listening. We're already thinking of our answer and how we're going to respond.
Yes.
And I think what we need to do is we need to listen to the patient first. Like I told you, I had a patient who said, you know, she's diabetic. I'm like, why are your sugars not well controlled? You know, and I'm going on. And she said, you're not hearing me. And she said, you're not listening to me. Mm-hmm. And I stepped back. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. And then I said, well, what is it that I can do then? Or what can we do to help you so that you can do your finger sticks? You know, what can we do to help in terms of nutrition? You know, so I mean, I'm happy she felt comfortable to do that, and that's what I want patients to do. Yes, there are going to be some physicians who are going to be offended, and I think that person needs to continue onward or just find another physician. Because I think as a physician, you know, you need to learn to listen to the patient. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Walker. On the basis of time, I do want to give our panelists a chance to talk a little bit about the Universal Home Visiting Program that is going to be so key in addressing some of these pieces that Dr. Walker was raising about the postpartum period. And then we'll be opening things up to questions from our audience. So
Okay, so yeah, this idea of universal home visiting, it's something that has come about. And, you know, one of the things when I heard about the state, you know, when they were in the infancy of thinking about developing this and putting this out, I said, gee, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Because when I had my babies in the 60s, you had a nurse who came to your home after one or 2 weeks. And I looked forward to that nurse because I had 4 babies in 5 years, you know? And the nurse would really support. So the idea of this universal home visiting, actually, it's only rolled out right now for 5 counties, Essex being one of them. And you have an opportunity, if you so desire, to have a registered nurse come to your home for a maximum of 3 visits and a minimum of 1 after you deliver it. There is no, and when we say universal, because that was my question, I said, you all are saying universal. Does that mean if I'm making $300,000 a year and I want that someone can come to my house? And they're like, yes. So when we talk universal, that's universal, because there was some, it was a little muddy a few years ago, but they've changed it. And so Essex County is one of those counties right now that has universal home visiting. It started in January, and our organization, the Partnership for Maternal and Child Health, there are 8 nurses. And we've certainly taken into consideration the linguistic, you know, when we think about what does Essex County look like, so we made sure we had English, Spanish, French, Creole, even Portuguese nurses who are able, they go, like I said, if you so desire, they will visit you 1 to 2 weeks after you get out of the hospital. Usually it's like maybe 10 days. That nurse comes and she does an assessment on you and the baby. And she needs to come a second time, but also will provide you with resources. And that connects to another program that we have. That is the Community Alignment Specialist Program. But the partnership doesn't have that for Essex, but there's the Essex Parenting and Pregnancy Connection that holds that. But it's just a wonderful, wonderful program. And I will tell you, in the first week that it started in January, 2 mommies were sent back to the hospital. Yes, and 2 babies, okay? They detected, they picked up something. You know, doctors, thank you so much for sharing. You know, when we think about, you know, the postpartum period, you know, this is a wonderful program that will support, you know, our birthing people postpartum. And in addition to that, as I said, one of the things that the state recognized a couple of years ago was like, we need to do something when women come home. We just can't, you know, can't be one and done. Oh, you had the baby. Oh, well, go on. She needs support for that first year if she chooses to have that. And I'm so grateful to be, you know, overseeing our postpartum program where any woman in Essex County, well, actually North, because what we had to do was limit the areas. And so we know North has the highest maternal mortality rate, you know, so our doulas, and I have 2 doulas who are, one is bilingual, one is African American. I did that distinction for a specific reason, because like does go to like, but people might prefer that. And we're really trying to engage our African American birthing people to be supported by this postpartum program. But the universal home visiting, you know, we're working with them. So let's say they're working with a mom, they can only see them a maximum of 3 times.
How long after your pregnancy?
Oh, and it's only up to 3 months, okay? So, but the thing is, if mom needs more support, they are connected, if they want to be, to our postpartum doula, who will be there for them for that full year. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about postpartum depression. We know it can rear its head 10 months. I had a client who, at 10 months, she had to be pulled out of work. That postpartum, the anxiety and the depression was so overwhelming, and a lot of people wouldn't think, oh, well, she didn't show it first. Or, well, we have that 12-month period where so many things can happen. And one of the other things with our universal home visiting, they do the Edinburgh, which is a scale that choose to, you know, to see if postpartum depression, and what we call is
mood disorders, because it's not just always about depression, like you mentioned. It can be anxiety. It can be obsessive and compulsive behavior. You know, these are some of the things that women experience, or birthing people experience, after they give birth. So universal home visiting, it's wonderful. Our flyers are in the back if you want to find out more about it. And by the way, it's going to be in all 21 counties in New Jersey, but they had to do a slow rollout. And of course, when we looked at it, you know, somebody mentioned what's happening in the southern part of the state. So I know Camden and Burlington County have universal home visiting, and Middlesex County. So up in the north, right now, we only have it in Essex. We do know that the request for a proposal, which is, you know, they're going to be rolling that out in June. And so the partnership will be going for Bergen, Passaic, and Morris County. So it is coming. It's eventually going to be in all counties, but it's going to be over a period of 4 years. And again, these nurses are highly trained. They are lactation consultants, which is great. And, you know, they can provide so much support and also resources for mom, you know, for that birthing person, whatever it is. They're connecting with another group, and she'll, and the nurse may report back, because there's a weekly meeting that happens, and say, you know, I worked with this family. These are the things that are going on, and this is what this mom needs. And she will be connected to a community health worker, Dr. Walker, and that community health worker will help, you know, will support her in, you know, getting the resources that they need. So I'm really happy about universal home visiting. We do have other evidence-based home visiting programs in the state of New Jersey. We have parents as teachers, and I'm saying this is across the state, not a partnership. We have the nurse family partnership, which is a little, which is different than this, because the nurses connect with mom up to 28 weeks gestation and pregnancy and stay with them until the baby's two. We have healthy families, where that can be anywhere from pregnancy until the baby is a year old, and they stay for 3 years with the family. And then we have parents as teachers. So the partnership, you know, up in the northern part of the state, we do have nurse family partnership in Union County, in Hudson County, and in Passaic County. Oh, and in Bergen County. So again, you know, if anyone is ever thinking about, you know, home visiting, and I know that people are skeptical about folks coming into their homes, given the history of child protective services when it comes to people of color through the years, and immigrants, you know, they may be wary. And so we're really trying to encourage, inform, and give our all residents of our community an opportunity to get the support that they want, desire, and that can be very useful to them. So again, please take the flyer about universal home visiting and our connecting NJ.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. In just a minute, we're going to turn it over to the audience to ask you all some questions, but I'd like to get us started, because you raise an issue, and each of you raised it, that I think is so important. In the context of so much medical mistrust, which is well deserved over the years, right? What can communities do? This is a community event. What can communities do to support birthing people, to ensure that they are aware of their rights and how they can advocate for themselves, and to connect them with the resources like the ones that Ms. Kinsella was describing, as well as other ones? So
I can start this off. We have, you know, in each county in New Jersey, there's something called a community advisory board, which is open to everyone, providers, clinicians, and the community. And I think it can start there. You know, this has been something that has really, you know, there's just some things that just eat at you. And for me, it's like, what can we do? What can I do? What can the system do? First of all, to be sensitive to the needs of the community, so the community doesn't feel like that's not where I'm going, because they don't have my best interests at heart. But how do we get, where does that engagement start? When can it happen? You know, we know that the mistrust wasn't built in a day.
didn't come up, you know, so it's gonna, we're gonna have to chip away at it. We just, I don't have an answer. I wish there were a silver bullet, maybe someone out here does, but I do think community coming together, raising Cain, letting these people know, those people who are, you know, putting our laws and policies together, you wanna know what their platform is. And if you don't, you know, and you know, when we talk about our students, I always tell them, because I teach in public health, you wanna make some changes, whatever your platform is, vote. If you agree with that platform, that's who you vote for. And I think that we've seen that in New Jersey, because our female legislators, Shavonda Sumter, Angela McKnight, they were the ones who got on that doula train and said, we've gotta start paying these doulas some money. And because of their efforts, we've seen what can happen through advocacy. So again, I think as a community, if you know, there is a wonderful community advisory board in Essex County, and you know, if you, there's something called Connecting MJ, that might be helpful. I mean, I just think coming together, because you know, that's gonna be a hard nut to crack. But we have to be honest with our providers. You talked about the Earth app, and Earth is, you just drop B. It's Earth. And putting, you know, what your experiences have been, and that's the whole goal of this. And Kimberly Stiers, who put this together, has been doing some work in other states. But we have to have a state that wants to be held accountable. These hospitals, she's trying to get them on board, because you want to know what your patients are feeling, what's been their experience, what are the changes. You know, we have some hospitals that are really trying to make the effort, but how do you make a community feel more comfortable? It starts with listening to them, you know? And so there is a campaign that is called Hear Her, you know, in New Jersey.
I mean, I agree. I think, I think one of the things is, I think we need to collaborate with a lot of the local organizations, and I've found that to be very helpful in the maternal field, because there are a lot of local organizations that are out here that are trying to improve the maternal health. And I think as a hospital, I think we need to collaborate more with these local organizations, and I think that will help improve some of the trust of the mistrust that is happening, you know, with the hospitals. I mean, everybody knows about, or maybe not about, the Dr. Sims, you know, who's considered the forefather of, you know, obstetrics, who, you know, he utilized treatment without pain medication for Black women. And then when he went to Europe, you know, he used pain medication for the white women. So there's definitely the mistrust. Yeah. There's definitely there. It was there with COVID and the vaccine, and it's just based on the history. And I think if we can include some of the local organizations, I think that can help also improve some of the relationship that we do have with the community.
Maybe even in real time, having like a patient advocate you can call when you're in the hospital and you're having trouble getting pain medications, or you're having trouble with the nurses.
Right.
Yeah. Right. True.
Yeah. And you know, I think sometimes people think, oh, okay, you're talking about Marion Sims, that was 1800. Let's move fast forward to Fannie Lou Hamer, who had what they called a Mississippi appendectomy. Right. These were the things that they were doing. Black women were going into hospitals for specific things, and then coming out not knowing that they actually performed tubal ligation. They sterilize these women without understanding. And not just Black women, our Puerto Rican women, what they did to them in like the 50s and the 60s. So when we're out here advocating and trying to pull people into programs, know that there's some kind of history. And unless we call people out, and I will tell you at St. Joseph's, one of the things that I was able to do was have a focus group for five groups, specifically Black women who had given birth in the last 2 years, to ask them what they thought of the hospital. It was unbelievable, because we were starting centering them. And I took that back and I said, this is what the people are saying. Mm-hmm. I said, people are not Black women are not coming here to give birth. Oh, yes, they are. I said, check your statistics. If they're delivering here, it's only because this is where their doctor's gone. They are not coming here for care. And one of the biggest reasons was there's no people who look like us, and we don't trust them. And I feel like if I go in there, I'm not going to come out alive. And I will tell, I will tell you that St. Joseph's took that very seriously. I was working with one of the midwives. We started going out into the community, but more importantly, they made sure every employee in that hospital received an implicit bias training by the People's Institute for Survival, which is a three-day anti-racist training. And we know that it can't be a one and done, but at least it started. So there are things that we as community can, you know, let's hold their feet to the fire. You know, whether they're the hospital, the provider, or our legislators. Like I said, we have some awesome women in our state legislature here in New Jersey.
No, I haven't.
So now I'd like to open it up to you, and thank you for joining us today. If you have questions, I'm sorry that this cord does not reach all the way back, but I likely ask you to come to the front with your questions. You, I can touch.
Thank you all so much. This is so informative, and I hope we don't have it every year for Black History Month, but until it gets solved, keep doing it, right? Hold on, I can't get it in. Thanks. My name is Victoria Latour Dunker. I have a podcast for those of advanced maternal age to navigate to and through pregnancy. And I've interviewed quite a few Black women who have had harrowing experiences. And one of them cited that the medical staff seemed to not even know of Dr. Sims of going through training, to the point even a Black physician as of late recently just really understood his long-lasting effect in gynecology, being the father of gynecology, and all the experimentation that he did on Black women. So that distrust is just so deeply rooted. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, how do you encourage a family to even hire a doula? Because it's like, especially in the Black community, I know for me and my husband was very hesitant to have someone come in and take away from his role, or just being someone, a third person. So how would you encourage someone who's not quite sure on what the benefits would be of having a doula, having another person in the room? That's question number one. My second one is, sorry, I had my notes. How would you guide someone in interviewing a provider, even giving them that feeling that it is an interview, you can actually hire your team? So what are the questions that you think would be important for someone who is expecting and their family to make sure that they feel like they have the right team in place from the get-go?
So I can answer about the doula. And so one of the things that our services, it's about family. As I mentioned, that last family I worked with, I knew grandma, I knew grandpa, I knew dad, and I went to say, these are the things that I can offer during pregnancy. This is what I can offer postpartum. This is what I can offer during labor and delivery. And so tell me how you see I can fit into your space, because for each person it's going to be individual. And I want to tell you, you know, I have to say this, our Black fathers take a lot of flack, but I will tell you, they are strong, they're courageous. All you have to do is watch the special, the one on Hulu with those dads. Why is this escaping me? But it's going to come to me beforehand. And it focuses on Black maternal health, but more than that, it talks about the three fathers who stepped in, three partners who stepped in and took care of those babies. It's called Aftershock. And if you have Hulu, watch it. And again, you know, we want to make sure that partner, male, female, whoever the partner is, that they're part of this whole process. There is a space for them, but they need to tell me how I fit in. You know, I don't want to overstep. And so
you know, one of the things to do with dads, there's exercises I show them that they can do that's going to help make the birth easier. And, you know, sometimes dad might be uncomfortable, but then they start enjoying it. Like, and I have them demonstrate in front of me. And so these are the things that you can do in early labor, you know, to get that, you know, to get that baby moving and whatnot. So I think what we are seeing is more and more Black women are requesting doulas. The problem here in New Jersey is we don't have the capacity for what we call a community doula, which is more affordable. And it would probably be covered by insurance. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, women who are receiving Medicaid, they have a better shot. But my question always is, what about the people who fall in between, mm-hmm. who don't have Medicaid, who have private insurance, and what are these private insurers doing to make sure they're offering the services? So I think we're going to hear more and more about doulas and the positive outcomes. And I think that's all we can do. And then you can take some of this information and just kind of spread it around, because we're here to serve the family.
And for you, those questions.
Yes. You're right. It is an interview. I think you need to ask them what the relationship is with the staff, especially the hospital. What's the hospital policy? I think that's actually very important, meaning that do they accept birthing plans? Mm-hmm. Or how receptive are they to accepting birthing plans? Who's allowed in labor? These are some of the questions that need to be asked. What's your C-section rate? I think that's very important.
Which you can find also at the cdc.gov site.
Right.
I didn't realize. You mentioned the New Jersey State Gov has some rates too, but
correct, they do. For each hospital, they have the cesarean section rate. So, but you know, you can find out what their personal cesarean section rate is, because you know, you talked about the fact that there's some providers who, you know, they want to go on vacation or whatever, and they want to get the delivery done prior to. And I understand, because they've been taking care of the patient, and they want to be part of that delivery as well, you know. But I think all of these things, you know, do you do unnecessary inductions? Mm-hmm. You know, there's some people who like to induce at a certain gestational age, just because.
Can I ask you about that? Because when I had this recent baby, I was told, well, the gynecologists have now discovered research that says that it's better to deliver 39 weeks, right? That's the optimal. And so if you haven't had the baby by then, they want you to schedule. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that the C-section rate is going to go much higher, mm-hmm. if that is the guideline by which gynecologists are operating right now.
Right. Well, actually, the study actually showed there was a decreased risk for cesarean section rate. And this was induction of labor of women who it was their first pregnancy. They induced them at 39 weeks, and the study showed that there was not an increased risk for cesarean section rate, and there was less maternal complications. But what we found when we started adopting that policy, we were inducing way too many people. And so we've pulled back on that policy right now. And I don't know if other hospitals are doing the same thing, but we found that they were unnecessary. Bottom line, and the question I have is, I don't know what discussion was had with the patient regarding the induction of labor. I know we're telling them, because it's not the gold standard, mm-hmm. It's just something that studies have shown that we can offer to the patient. But I think if the patient says, no, I'd rather wait, we should allow that patient to wait. I've had some patients who were adamant that they did want 39 weeks, and if me dealing with high-risk pregnancies, a lot of times I am inducing patients at 38, 39 weeks just because of their medical condition. But for the low-risk patient, I think that, I think at least in our hospital, we're moving away from the induction at 39 weeks because of the fact that we were just doing too many inductions.
Did that study have a diverse population in it?
That's a good question. I can't remember. I almost want to say yes, but I don't quote me on that. Yes.
Thank you.
I'd love to take one more question from our audience, and then we're going to wrap up.
My name is Heidi Basai. I work at the New Jersey Healthcare Quality Institute. I believe we partner with several of you, or probably all of you at this table, which is wonderful. My question that I wrote down, because I also like writing them better. I think a lot of men don't know where their space is when it comes to pregnancy. And so I was just wondering, do you have any advice for male partners and how they can be a part of, as you said, the birthing team, kind of circle around the birthing person? So thank you very much.
Or maybe, and also maybe female partners.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you.
I think they're very important. We're trying to definitely, in terms of centering, for instance, we're involving them in the centering program, including those with children. You know, sometimes they don't have a babysitter, so children are there in the centering program. And I think it is important. The studies have shown, right, that if you have a partner involved, that the outcome is better. And at least in the centering program, like I said, we're trying to involve the partners. I don't think we have anything specific. I mean, it is a good question. There are a lot of community organizations that are now involving the male. As a matter of fact, for our Black Maternal Health Week in April, one of the sessions is going to be run by a gentleman talking about male involvement in pregnancy. So it is a topic that needs to be discussed, because it is important in terms of having a partner involvement in the pregnancy.
Yeah, and I just want to add, there are fatherhood programs, and we need to let our dads know that they are needed, they're valuable. I will tell you, when I had my babies, back when they were pushed to the side, you don't matter, like my husband didn't. The only thing he knew when he came in the room, the baby was born and I was there. At that time, they weren't allowing males in the delivery room. So I think that this is a great opportunity, and there are wonderful fatherhood programs. In fact, in Essex County, there's a fatherhood program called FELLAS, F-E-L-L-A-S. I don't know what the acronym stands for, but again, and they're really trying to engage dads. And by the way, in Southern New Jersey, we have some male doulas. You know, dads who decided, hey, I want to be a part of this process. So as much as we feel that dads don't want to be involved, they do. And we just need to figure out what's going to work within our own communities to, you know, pull them into this birthing space and let them know you are an intricate part of this process.
Can I say one more?
Oh, sure.
I just wanted to say, too, about the provider thing. When you're picking a provider, knowing what you want is really helpful, because I didn't realize that, like, I went to one person, she was the one who saw me the whole time. Mm-hmm. Then at some point she was like, oh, I want an actual life, I'm going to have other people in my practice. So then she started, with this last pregnancy, she was rotating. So I didn't know who was going to be at my pregnancy when I had delivered. I saw a different person each time. That was very different than my first experience when I saw only one person, and she was the one who delivered me. When I tried to switch because of the whole weight thing, I went to another practice that everybody loved. They loved the doctor there, but I found out you really only see the doctor when you deliver. The whole time leading up to that time, you see midwives. And you don't even see the same one, you see a rotating set of midwives. So I think knowing that kind of stuff is stuff that I didn't know going into it, but those are kind of questions like, how does your practice work? Do you see does a patient see the same doctor each time? Does a patient know who's going to deliver them ahead of time? Or is it just somebody who's on the practice? Like, that stuff is useful. And even though I have a love-hate relationship with mom groups, my God. Some of that is useful, because if you come down to a set of practitioners, you can say in a mom's group, hey, I narrowed it down to these four or five. If you know of anything, if you've had any experiences, can you reach out and let me know? People almost certainly will share, when, especially if they've had certain either really good or bad experiences. So I say use that stuff. And I agree with you. I think most people want doulas. I mean, I think most people want to have someone in a room who's going to help them and advocate for them and be present, especially when you have other kids, your partner might have to go home, or, yeah. and you don't have someone in the room with you that whole time. And so, and doula, I had a doula with my second, and she helped me when I got home because she wasn't in the room because we ended up doing a C-section. So she helped me put clothes away and looked at the baby. And so that stuff is useful. I think it's an easy sell. I think what you're saying that, like, actually getting it covered is the hard part.
I would also just add to the question about encouraging families to hire doulas. When I trained as a doula Lothis many years ago, one of the things that I always talked about was how I could be a resource for the partner. That in the middle of birth, partners are often very anxious, they're very tired, and it can be helpful to have another person there to support both the partner and the mom. And so encouraging doulas and also birth teams to talk about the benefits of having how doulas and other members of the birth team can support not just the birthing person, but a partner. And thinking about things holistically can also support that as well.
One last thing. If you can't walk, because I couldn't in this last pregnancy, like, that is a real thing, and you should get physical therapy for it. And, like, your doctor might